everybody. This is old Grandma Moses on the road again. Ah, what a bunch you are. Gosh, I never saw such a friendly, outgoing group of people in my life. And this is a big convention. I sat in that the rear part this afternoon to listen to Winnie. And I was amazed. I truly was, because I had no notion of how many people would be here when I left Los Angeles. Look out there. Look at the side. All of those places filled, and I see people standing up back here and there, and maybe some out the door there, and I have no way to count them. But it's just been a beautiful weekend, and I just wish there was some way that I could get Bob to agree with me that we move to Louisiana, because I don't want to go home tomorrow. I've enjoyed it thoroughly, every minute of it. You're too good to me, though. I just don't deserve anything special because I've been sober so long. There's no difference in me and you. And I want it that way. I don't want to be deprived of any of the benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous. The coffee after the meeting, sitting in restaurants and talking about what's happened to us, all the good things that we do in AA after the meeting. At least we do in our town. We go to a great many meetings in the Pasadena area. And as soon as the meeting over, my husband Bob, who's a longtime member, and his little bunch of babies, or pigeons, whatever you call them here, we go to the restaurant, which is a block away from our Sunday morning meeting, and we all get a big table, and we eat or have coffee or something or other. And it's just hard to break up our group after the meeting. Sometimes I think the meetings after the meeting are just as important as the meeting itself. Close ranks and want to be with each other after a meeting. It's really important. I didn't know anything about all that when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because the only life I knew was in a bar, and I didn't want to behave that way at all. Never did. Never did want to behave the way I did. And I wondered why I didn't have any choice, because at all times I was doing the very best I could. I felt so ashamed and so disgraced about my drinking. And I couldn't understand why that I kept making those promises and then broke them all the time. And I suppose that what I've said so far has been said by most of you, but I forgot the most important thing, because I get started talking and I forget something that's tremendously important. Now, someone was behind this group of people to say, why don't we have Sybil out here to talk? And your committee, I don't know how many are on it or anything, but I just want to thank them from the bottom of my heart, because I've never had a better time in my life. It's just a smaller Montreal, really. I mean, I was in Montreal 3 weeks ago, as were some of you. I saw your hands raised the other day. And I'm enjoying myself immensely. And I'm not ready to go home. I just wish that we could start this thing all over again tomorrow for a day or two, until finally we all got so tired we just lay out there in the aisles. And I'll stay if you will. I really would. Now, I'm that kind of a person that if a thing is good, it's good. But in my drinking days, everything wore off. I'd have a new enthusiasm, and I would be happy with that, and I'd drop it like a hot potato. I was a good starter, and I was a very poor finisher, and my conscience would bother me, and so I'd drink. I started drinking when I was 15 or 16. I've been sober so long, I've forgotten. But it was in my early teens, and that I know well. And the reason I know that it was in my early teens, when we moved away from Burke Burnett, Texas, and before that we were in Waco, and we were in Burke Burnett doing the big oil boom there in 1921. And I had a big brother that I adored, Tex Adams, and he had disappeared, and Mom and Papa thought he was dead for several years. And then we got a postcard from an anonymous friend of ours, of his, saying, your son is alive and well in Los Angeles, and he lives at, I'll make up the address, 150 Diamond Street in Los Angeles. And so we packed up and moved to California when I was 13. Now, I was somewhat of an oddball. Can you turn my little clock? I better put my little clock up here. I'll talk 3 or 4 days. We got 3 o'clock. I can see real well, see. I'm going to cheat a little bit and say I started at 8:45. And forget what I said so far, it won't count. When I moved from Berkmanet, Texas, and came out here, I was 13 years old. And it was a rough town, very rough town. I saw a man fall from the top of an oil derrick, and I was just a little girl, and he just splattered on the ground. It was not a good sight. That did not make me an alcoholic, but that was a rough town. We lived in army camps. And Papa was very strict with me. He didn't want his little girl to be contaminated by a rough bunch of roughnecks in an oil boom. And so when we moved to Los Angeles, because my brother Tex was there, and I went to grammar school there in Los Angeles, I was an oddball. In the first place, I'm not knocking my father or the way he was brought up or anything, but he was a typical breed that thought that I was made of sugar and spice and everything nice and nothing ever bad was going to happen to his little girl, I guess, because he never would let me cut my hair. And it was unusually long and hard to handle. And that's not important in this day and age, but it was to me because I didn't know what to do with it. And because that Berkmanet was such a rough town, they were oblivious to the way I dressed my hair. I would, at that time, they'd tease it up into puffs on both sides, and then I had all that long hair that should have been hanging down my back. I had that in some kind of a knot on the back of my head. And the girls in my school wore something called tan no more. And it was like white shoe polish, really. But it was to keep you from tanning. And they would spread that white stuff on their faces and wet a sponge. And then they'd put rouge there because it was a rough town and they had chorus girls there made up heavily. And they'd dance for the guys that were working in the oil field. So we made up our faces like that. But again, Papa or Mama, they didn't object. And, I moved to Los Angeles and went to grammar school there the first day, and they laughed at me. I didn't know any better. I looked around. They didn't look like me. I looked like a... I don't know what I looked like. I guess I looked like a midget or something. All made up for a circus. I don't know. But I felt very unpopular, and I probably was. And eventually, I acquired one girlfriend, and we were inseparable. She probably had to be an oddball, too. And then my parents were very poor, so I left school, went to high school for a while, took a short-term business course, and I became a legal secretary, and I was a good one. But I drank, and they didn't know it, because Papa always said he wanted it to impress you, so he would say it so that you'd remember it all your life. If a subject came up about alcohol, he'd say, "No, sir, I wouldn't take a little dram of whiskey." I'll tell you, though, what, if a man came up to me and said, "Mr. Adams, you were bitten by a rattlesnake. I saw him bite you, and it's going to kill you. But I've got a little bottle of whiskey in my pocket here, and I can take an eyedropper of that whiskey and put it on that rattlesnake wound, and it will heal instantly." Papa said, "You know what I'd tell that man if that happened?" "No, sir. Don't put a drop of alcohol on my body. Just get a rusty knife and cut my arm off up to the shoulder blade." And a little girl like me, I'd look up at Papa and I'd say, "What is that stuff? That whiskey?" I couldn't wait to find out. So at the very first opportunity after we moved out to Los Angeles and I shaped up a little bit, Papa wouldn't let me cut my hair, and all the kids wore their hair short. And I wasn't popular, and I knew it. I had one girlfriend, and I wasn't allowed to go out with the boys. I was not allowed to have them walk home with me or anything. And again, I didn't fit in. I didn't fit in at all. And so I finally got to where I would jump out the window at night, and they thought I was asleep, and I'd go over 2 blocks away where my one girlfriend lived, and she had a cousin by the name of Jimmy, and Jimmy had a motorcycle. And we would ride it, and we were courting, I suppose you'd say. And he asked me to go to a matinee movie Saturday, and I said, "I'll ask Papa." So I said, "Papa, there's a boy over on the next street that wants to take me to a movie at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon. Can I go?" He says, "You'll not leave this house with a boy or a man until you're 18 or married." I said, "Well, I'll get married." And I did. And so I'll tell you my name now. My name is Sybil Doris Adams Stratton Hart Maxwell Willis Horowitz. And I'm an alcoholic. The other four guys, but the fifth one, Bob Corwin, is sober 22 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll phone him after this meeting and tell him all about it and what has happened before and what I think will happen tomorrow, and then I'll see him tomorrow night. And I don't want to go home, Dad. I just wish somebody would adopt me. But I guess at 77 years old, I'm a little too old for anybody to want to take me home with them. But I felt such a tremendous guilt about every little thing that I did that was not the way my parents wanted me to be. Jimmy and I were married, and I got married as soon as he told me that, and he was a good boy, and he was just like a brother. And we were married 3.5 years, and I went to work in order to make some money. And it blew up because we were too young. He was 18, I was 15 or 16. And then I met a sailor. Papa wouldn't let me dance yet after I left Jimmy and came back home, wouldn't let me do anything at all. So I went down to a dime a dance hall downtown that had dance matinees at 2 o'clock on Saturdays. And I met a sailor, good-looking blonde boy, 19 or 20, and we got married. We had little girls. And by this time, my drinking was so bad that I couldn't take care of her, and so Mama kept her for me. I just adored her. I remember picking that little baby up when she was 6 months old, and saying, honey, your mama's going to quit drinking for you. Because I don't want you to grow up and have a drunken mama. I want to be a good wife and mother. I really want to be a good wife and mother. I meant that. I really did. And yet Bill and I were unable to quit drinking. I never thought of him as an alcoholic. He was drinking with me all the time. He was a good guy. I look back on it now. We had no money. And then the big depression was on. And we had to get some money to support that baby. So we hitchhiked out of town and got a ride on a truck, and we wound up about 100 miles from Los Angeles in a little town called Arvin. And it was hot as it is here. It was hot summertime, but they were picking grapes. And the young people of that era would pick grapes or follow the fruit of the season, clear up to Hood River, Oregon, and pick apples, which I did. Follow, you know, whatever was ready to pick, we'd pick it. But at any rate, I thought, getting out in the sun, I remember how I felt, sweating and getting a sunburn and cutting those grapes loose and putting them in the trays for 4 cents a box. And at the end of the day, I made $4, and so did Bill. I thought, at the end of the summer, we'll have a good stake of money, and we can go and get the little girl and get an apartment and have my little baby a place of my own. And I don't need to drink, because this is so healthy, what I'm doing. I worked awfully hard that day. I feel pretty proud of myself. But when nightfall came, that young crowd of people, and in that era, they were all just college kids working for fun or for tuition for college in the fall. A nice, clean bunch of kids. They built a big bonfire, and they all began to harmonize and sing. And so Bill and I kind of got up close, and they moved a little bit, and we sat down and just didn't enjoy ourselves. We were very tired. And then the worst thing possible happened. I saw them start passing a bottle around. I'm 125 miles from home. And I thought, oh, no, not here. And I looked around the campfire. It was a big one. It had to be a big semicircle for all of the fruit workers to be around it. And I saw another bottle headed my way. And it never occurred to me that I could say no thank you and pass it on to the one on my left. Because when that bottle got to me, I had been just salivating, waiting for it to get to me, and I drank the whole thing. And the other bottle reached me about the same time, and I turned it up, and I realized what I'd done. And I jumped up from that campfire, and I staggered down the row of grapes, and I looked up at the moon and the stars, and the tears were pouring down my cheeks, and my face was dirty, and it made little rivulets of dirt down my cheeks. And I must have been 18 or 19 by then. And I never felt so full of sorrow in my life. And I wanted to die. And I thought I was getting my wish because all of a sudden I heard heavenly music. Eerie, beautiful music. And I thought, uh-oh, I got drunk once too many. I heard Grandpa talk about the DTs, and I guess I got them. That's what it is. He heard voices. And I'm hearing them, only it's pretty. It's really pretty. But I was scared, so I started to run to get away from the music, which was unreal. But I ran into it, and it was real music. It was a revival tent that they had pitched there in that little farming town, one of those great big khaki tents. And the preacher had been preaching, and they were singing hymns, don't you see? And I was very emotional by this time, and I know it wasn't as big as this room, but it was a huge khaki tent, a couple hundred people in it anyway. And I pushed the flap of the tent aside just as the music stopped. And they all turned around and looked at me, a pitiful-looking young woman, dirty, tears, drunk. And the preacher, he sized up the situation. And he said, as we sing this next hymn, turn to page 39. And as we sing it, if there's one here who would like to be saved, please come forward and I'll pray for you. And they all started singing and looking at me, and I started staggering down that church aisle. I thought I'd never get there. And they did, too, because they were kind of mentally healthy. And so when I got up to the altar, the preacher, they were still singing. He put his hand on my head to pray for me, and I threw up all over him. Somebody lifted me up and put me out on the ground, lifted up the flap of the tent and put me out on the ground. When I came to, I hitchhiked over to the highway that would take me over the ridge route and into Los Angeles. I got on a truck, and this truck driver was very sympathetic, and he drove me right to my mother's door where my baby was. And that was bad, very bad, bad, bad. But the worst was yet to come. That didn't do anything for me except just make me ashamed of myself and want to do better. But that didn't happen either. When I got a divorce because of Bill's drinking, and he couldn't find a job when he got paid off out of the Navy, and it was a pretty desperate situation, and we got to squibble squabbling, and I was young and unstable and drinking, and so was he. It was a kind of a bitter time. I couldn't find any work, but the attorney that had gotten my divorce put me to work for him and taught me to be a legal secretary. So I got a job with the Retail Merchants Credit Association, and I had gone to high school long enough to know shorthand and typing, and that's what I did. And I couldn't get any real booze because the repeal thing hadn't come along, so I would drink drugstore wine called Padre. It's about half medicine and half wine. It'll make you rum dumb, and it's a terrible drink, but it would get the job done. And my brother Tex had become a bootlegger. Still, times were very bad, and he was a bootlegger, and I'd sit in his joint and drink his booze, and then he'd drink with me, and then he'd get in a fight, and then the cops would come, and they'd put him in jail, and they'd drive me home. And that went on for a while, and I got this little girl. And Tex was always getting in jail. I bailed him out 89 times out of Lincoln Heights. And I was telling some of the girls yesterday that the cops always turned me loose, and we did the same things together. He was a big bruiser, 300 pounds from Texas, and he'd roar and bellow and get in a fight, and they'd throw him in the pokey and say, "You poor little thing." And they put me in the back seat to sober up and let me sleep there, and then they'd drive me home. And they shouldn't have done it, I guess. But, of course, there was no AA then for me to go to anyway. And things got rougher, so I went, wanted to make some money for the child. So I got a job as a taxi dancer. And Bob, my husband, says, "Honey, there's no one living now that knows what a taxi dancer is or why." He said, "When you mention that, you must explain that that's a dime a dance girl where the fellow buys a string of tickets if he likes the girl, and the music will go about as far if he dances, drops a ticket in the thing. He can dance with you about as far as that water pitcher. He's dead. Unless he buys a string of tickets, and a whole string will last about 15 minutes. And then he has to spend a lot of money and get some more tickets." And all of a sudden, this bespectacled, well-dressed, good-looking man, 3 years older than I was, bought all the tickets for the evening, and he danced with me. And at intermission, we'd go out where they were serving pitchers of beer at $1 a pitcher. And in drinking that, I would get 50 cents off each pitcher, and I got drunk besides, and I thought that was a good deal. So I got maudlin. You understand, it was my first or second night there. That was the beginning and end of my career. Because I got to whining and crying and telling him, I don't want to be here. I got a little girl at home. Isn't this terrible? And I'm reduced to being down here on Skid Row in a lousy place like this. I'm a legal secretary, and I can do this, and I can do that, and here I am, and I don't want to be here, but I got to make some money. And I did this, didn't do it to get him. I wasn't thinking of a man. I really wasn't. I was just pitiful, is what I was. And he listened to my long, sad, whining story, and he said, oh, my dear, what you need is financial security, and you've told me about your little girl. She must be adorable, and I like children, and I'm single, and what you're working here for is a very good motive. It's to make money for your child, and you just don't like to be in this environment, and I don't blame you, and I can take you away from all this. I have money. You need money. I'll adopt your child. I love children. So let's get married. And I said, let's do. So we got married. Nothing changed, except better circumstances. And that just shows you that money doesn't have a thing to do with alcoholism. Because for 17 years, that patient man, after he adopted my baby, she adored her father. She's a wonderful lady. She's been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous now nearly 4 years. She's 54 years old, that baby of mine. I'm proud of her. The best part of Montreal is she talked at one of the afternoon marathons there. And I just was so proud of her, I couldn't stand it. I talked Friday night, but to see my baby standing up there and doing a good job in AA in the little town of Hollister where she lives in a little farming area there. Beautiful blonde girl with blue eyes, has 5 kids, all good kids but one. They're all married or in college. And one is a narcotic and a drug addict, and Grandma Sybil can't and won't touch her with a 10-foot pole. You know why? I'd kill her. I mean, with love. Come on, stay with me, baby. I'll take care of you. No, no. She called up. She left home when they lived in Seattle. And she called up from a phone booth about 7 or 8 years ago. And she called me Bebo because that's my family name. She couldn't say Sybil, so she says, Bebo, this is April. My family, in quotes, she was in that hippie era. My family deserted me here in Sherman Oaks, and they took any money that I had, and I had to panhandle the money to call you. I'm in a phone booth out here in Sherman Oaks. Will you come and get me? I said, yes, baby doll, I'll be there as soon as they can. So I went and got her, and I drove her down to the hole in the ground, the group that my brother started, and I went in that empty, it's kind of like a club, they don't call it that. There's people there all day long at coffee serve. And I took her over to them, and I said, this is my granddaughter. Do something with her. I'm going home. She said, what are you going to do with me? I said, you're right here. I think you're in good hands. I'm leaving you. I'm trying to save your life. So one of the girls took her home, and she stayed there and stayed sober a year. Got married, had a little baby, and went back to doping and using, and so that's the way it is today. But this is a vicious disease, especially when it's mixed with pills or narcotics and booze. She's so beautiful, it's just hard to look at her to this very hour. And she has 2 little kids. And that's in my own family, and I'm not saying it's inherited at all. It's just the disease of alcoholism. I think a relative can do less for a relative than a complete stranger. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. Someone you never laid eyes on before comes along and says, come with me and take my hand and go down there and see those people, and you'll like what you see and you'll stay sober. And thank God it happened to me. But I couldn't believe it, because I was sobering up one more time after this guy that I got married to that met me in the taxi dance hall had adopted her. Of course, I was drunk within the week, and for many, many years he put up with it. And I was still progressing into the disease, not knowing. I was so ashamed, didn't know what to do at all. And finally, he laid the law down to me. I came home, late one night after I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm jumping ahead, but I'll go back in a little bit. And I had been going to AA for quite a while, and he was all for it. And I don't know whether this has ever happened to another alcoholic woman or not. He was strictly a non-alcoholic with a beautiful family. And I had a beautiful home and a housekeeper, and everything was going well, but he resented AA after a while. He thought that I could go to AA and they'd vaccinate me or something, I guess, and that I'd come home all fixed up and be a good housekeeper and a wife and a mother like I was supposed to. And here he'd gone into several years, and he wasn't going to put up with it. I came home from a meeting one night, and he said, "Honey, I've got the solution to our marriage. You're gone all the time. You're always gone, and I'm so lonely. And the solution is this. Now, think about this, honey. I've got the answer. Now, if you go back to drinking like you did in the good old days, I'll take care of you." And my heart nearly broke. That faithful, good man that had adopted my child wanted me to die, but he didn't know that. He would not go to Al-Anon. He would not go to meetings. You see, I don't have a drinking problem. Why should I go? Oh, maybe he'd go Christmas when we'd have a potluck dinner or something. But he had no understanding of it whatsoever, and he couldn't understand why I was going after all that time. And so he said, I'd rather see you drunk. It would be better than this. And he went on upstairs, and I thought for a long time, and I had goose pimples. And I was just sick all over. It was the end of my world. And my daughter had just gotten married at 16, and I didn't want to stay home anymore with a man that just wouldn't put up with AA. I didn't know what to do, and he was a great man. So I quietly tippy-toed upstairs, and I got a little suitcase, and I packed what I could in it, and I went downstairs, and I walked out. I saw my new car in the driveway, and I started to get in it, and I thought, nope, make a clean break. You didn't have a dime when you met him, except the dimes that the guys had dropped in the slot when they danced with you. And I walked down, got a streetcar, got off at Adams and Figueroa, and started all over. Got a housekeeping room in one of those old mansions down there for $10 a week. There was a gas plate and a bedroom and a bathroom across the hall. Next morning, I got up and went down to the Times newspaper and got a job on the newspaper. And I never looked back. Now, I had to do that. He made out okay. It was hard for me. I'd take a streetcar out of the hole in the ground in Huntington Park, the group that my brother Tex started, because my brother came into AA 2 weeks after I did. Now, the way I got AA really is such a simple thing, but it was just by chance, I guess. I used to take Turkish baths when I'd get drunk to sober up so that I'd look good when I went home and I could tell a good lie. And I was pudgy, and sometimes I'd take a Turkish bath to lose a little weight. And I had wound up in San Francisco, 450 miles away, on a running drunk, and I knew when I got home that good man that didn't, you know, wanted me to go back to drinking, that he was going to divorce me and get custody of that little girl. And so I didn't know what to do. And so I went to this Turkish bath, and I thought, my God, I don't want to think. I got to read something just to forget about my head. And I'll pick up a good lie and go home in the morning. So there's a newsstand there, and I picked up the Saturday Evening Post, and then after I had the Turkish bath, I picked it up. And I was too bleary-eyed to really read anything, but boy, I couldn't help seeing on the cover Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander, and that magazine was dated March 1st, 1941. And I turned the page, and there was a full-page spread of a man being put in an ambulance, and my mind said, because I couldn't read the article, I was too sick, but I'd heard of AA in 1939 in Liberty. Fulton Osler had written a little piece called Alcoholics and God. They were putting this man in an ambulance. My mind, this was clear as a bell, to an AA hospital to get cured. And I thought, oh, that's that thing I read about in 1939. Now, Sybil, you know you never do follow through with anything because of your drinking. If you're going to do something about your drinking, you're going to have to do it while you're hungover and sick. You've got to do it now. So I pushed the button, and they brought me a pen and paper and stamp and an envelope, and I wrote a very desperate letter.
And I said, I'm a desperate woman alcoholic. I don't want to drink. I've ruined my life, my husband's, and my daughter's, and I can't live like this. Please tell me where your cure is, your Alcoholics Anonymous cure is. You can tell I didn't read the article. And I'll come back to your hospital and take your cure. I'll take the next plane. And I went home, and I was in the real estate business then, and the good non-alcoholic husband hadn't laid the law down. That was many years later. And I sneaked in and hungover as I could possibly be, and I waited for my answer, and it came right away. Now, I saw Ruth Hawk, Bill Wilson's secretary, when AA started, in Montreal. She sat there she talked the same night I talked at the stadium. And I looked at that lady. She's in her 60s now, and she was 24 when she answered my letter, this pitiful letter. She had her daughter with her, and I had my daughter with me, and it was full circle. And I just wept when she talked there in Montreal, because this girl, 24 years old, had very little work to do for Bill Wilson and Hank Parkhurst before AA. They had a little auto accessories business, and they weren't making a dime. And they were supposed to pay her $25 a week, which they didn't have. So this AA thing was invented, in quote. We know it isn't that. But when it came along, they didn't have any money to pay her then. And she had very little correspondence to answer about AA until the Saturday Evening Post article came out. Well, when I wrote my desperate letter for help, obviously, it got there ahead of all the big bundles of mail. She told me up in Montreal she had to get volunteers, many volunteers, to answer the mail. The first major publicity that we'd had. They kept coming in, kept coming in. It simmered down after a month or two. Thousands and thousands and thousands. Thank God my letter got there early. A little gray-haired lady now in her 60s, and she spoke in Montreal. Gave us a little bit of the early history. And I thought, well, it's come full circle. The gal that answered my call for help is here. She's sitting there, and I'm sitting here, and I can't hardly stand it. It was just too much. And so I hung around with her quite a bit in Montreal, I just stayed at her heels. I couldn't get over it. And she told me in that letter, she said, you don't have to come back to New York to find help, and besides, it's not an AA hospital. AA started in California December the 1939, and they only have a few men. They've never had any success with a lady drunk. And we haven't had too much success here in New York, but we do have a gal now who has been sober 8 or 9 months, and her name is Marty Mann. And she says, I'm enclosing a pamphlet for you and giving you the phone number to call if you need help, which she did. And so my non-alcoholic husband drove me down there to the meeting in the Elks Temple in Los Angeles, and they were sitting around a table like that. I had a red turban on and bleary-eyed, sick as I could possibly be. And it was just, I wanted to make myself invisible. I didn't want them to see me, but there I sat. Pretty soon this man at the table got up and rapped a gavel, and he said, this is a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in California. We're a band of ex-drunks who've gathered together to obtain and maintain our sobriety on an all-time basis. With no mental reservations whatsoever. And I thought, what an order. I can't go through with that. I had unusually heavy hair, and it came way down to here, and I had to stuff it up under a red turban, and my eyes were bloodshot, my cheeks were swollen, and I was twitching and jerking, and my lip, this lip here, kept twitching, and I was afraid they'd see that. Can't be sober 44 years and 4 months. That Saturday Evening Post article that I read, written by Jack Alexander, saved my life in March of 1941, and I haven't had that drink since. And we've acknowledged that already tonight, so you don't need to applaud that again. Because we were doing it on an all-time basis because we didn't know any better. And then came a day at a time. But you know what? Sometimes these days when things get rough, I don't think about a drink. I'm just thinking about my life. I'm 77 going on 78, so I want to live to be 100. And I might be back here when I'm 99, if you'll let me. But the way I feel about that is that AA will withstand anything that comes along in your life if you'll share it with your sponsor or with some new person. Bob and I sponsor a lot of young people. I mean, they're not really young. It's just that we're pretty old. And they help us a lot more then we help them. And we're continually working with guys in various stages of sobriety and women, 3 months sober, 6 months sober, 9 months sober. And they pay me back by driving me to meetings because I can't see well enough to drive my car, and I've got it parked in the garage and haven't used it for 2 years. So I'll get on the phone, call one of Bob's babies, and he drives me. Now, I'm not using them. They seem to think it's a pleasure. They live 10 minutes away. It's in our neighborhood. And that's another story. But working with Russ, it repays you in more ways than I can tell you. In other words, it's a medicine, the only medicine I know, that can keep us sober and make us like it. Because there's no other way in the world. Right now, AA is so easy to find. When I came in, it was not. And my husband, Bob, has a favorite expression. He said, so many people died way back there, Sid, when you came in, that they were ashamed to come to AA because they didn't know it was a disease. And he said, now AA has had such favorable publicity that it's sort of fashionable to go down there. We don't have to be ashamed anymore. Everybody knows about AA, and it's just a great thing. You don't need to feel ashamed the way I did, and it's a happy way to go. And I think we're all newcomers. I think I'd punch anybody in the nose to call me an old-timer. I really do. Next March, I'll have my 45th birthday, and that, to me, is just a beginner, because in the book it says, more will be revealed to us. Now, AA, at 50 years, we don't know it all yet. More will be revealed to us, and that's right. What I'm getting at is that guy sitting there with 37 years, he stood up, he doesn't know it all yet. He knows that. And I don't know it all. More will be revealed to us. And these young people are going to pick it up when we leave. And it's going to go on and on and on, and we don't know where we're headed. We know that we will always have our 12 steps and our 12 traditions and our third legacy and so on. And there may be other good things added after I'm gone. I don't know anything about all that. I don't care. I know it's working superbly all over the world. All over the world. My husband goes up to Alaska to see the Eskimos, who have a small group up there. He's been up there numerous times. And they killed a buffalo, and they wanted him to bring the buffalo back to give to Sybil. And he said, no, thank you. I don't think I'd like to carry it on the plane. And so you see AA is wherever you go. It doesn't matter whether it's at the North Pole or whether, I said Alaska, I meant up in northern Canada. All over the world. And we saw that in Montreal. Everybody of every nationality, they know where to come. And they're so young. I sponsored a girl, 13. She's now 24, and she's an attorney. Her name is June. You may have had her here. I see a head nodder there. We can't be too young and we can't be too old. We have the gray beards here, the older fellows, and we have the kids, and thank God for them. I think a lot of the kids sit in the back. I went to a meeting this afternoon, and they're getting younger and younger and younger, and I just love sitting back there and seeing. They look so terribly interested in the speaker, as well they might, and so was I. I've enjoyed everybody just talk. In the final analysis, I'll put it this way before I sit down. Never, never call a person who's been sober a long time an old-timer. Because AA itself is new. I mean, compare it with any fine literature or any wise things that's been said or read or written. And AA is really in its infancy, if you want to look at it that way. Long after we are gone, somebody else will be doing what we are. They may add another set of something or other called another thing other than the traditions. If anyone had told me we'd have traditions, I wouldn't have believed it. We have those. They work well. Something else good may be added. I don't know. It's that AA is here to stay because every one of you would fight for it if you had to. It's our very lifeblood, and we know that, and we're happy with it. If we weren't happy with it, we'd quit. We'd get drunk. We'd die. No, that's not the way it's going to be. So what I'm trying to say is, I'm a newcomer. So are you, relatively speaking. We're like little birds learning to fly. So a little fledgling learning to fly, may the wings of your happiness never lose a feather. Thank you. God bless you.